Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we honor our fathers in our annual celebration of Father's Day. As anyone who is one knows well, being a father or a mother is not easy. We spend much of our time worrying about our children and their future. And believe it or not, that's the subject of our interview this week with Peter Stearns, the author of Anxious Parents, A History of Modern Child Rearing in America. After that, James Banner returns to Talking History with his commentary on the European Union's recent failure to write a constitution. But first, Dan Roberts, in A Moment in Time, concludes his two-part series on William Jennings Bryan and his Cross of Gold.
At the Democratic Convention of 1896, the candidate chosen was William Jennings Bryan, the Prairie Orator, a champion of free silver.
A Moment in Time with Dan Roberts.
The burning issue in the campaign of 1896 was money. Debtors, such as small farmers whose wheat and cotton were declining in price, wanted the government to increase the amount of silver coins in circulation, thereby making it easier for them to buy equipment and pay off their loans. Creditors, such as banks and railroads, wanted the government to stick with the gold standard because gold was considered more valuable. The Democrats in 1896 dumped their incumbent President Grover Cleveland and chose instead a 36-year-old former congressman from Nebraska, William Jennings Bryan. Bryan was born and raised in Illinois, but his political reputation was made on the plains of Nebraska. In an era of dull establishment politicians, he was a spellbinding orator. He believed that success in life flowed directly from hard work and a virtuous life. Bryan harbored typical Midwestern disdain for Eastern power centers, bankers, and industrialists, who he thought abused the unconnected little guys out in the backcountry, and he hated gold. During the convention, he translated this rather arcane discussion of monetary policy into an issue of patriotism, and did so with near religious fervor. You shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold. Bryan was buried in a tidal wave of votes fueled by Republican money and fears of his emotional and populist rhetoric. Three times, the Democrats followed Bryan to electoral disaster at the University of Richmond. This is Dan Roberts.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, nearly 40,000 people have cast more than 300,000 votes as part of a national initiative titled The People's Vote, wherein Americans were asked to vote on which of some 100 documents they believe shaped the nation. The People's Vote was co-sponsored by the National Archives, National History Day, and U.S. News and World Report. The 10 documents that received the most votes were the Declaration of Independence with 76% of the votes, the U.S. Constitution with 69%, the Bill of Rights 68%, the Louisiana Purchase Treaty 34%, the Emancipation Proclamation 33%, the 19th or Woman Suffrage Amendment to the U.S. Constitution 31%, the 13th Amendment, which made slavery unconstitutional 30%, the Gettysburg Address 25%, the Civil Rights Act, 25%, and the Social Security Act, with 21% of the vote. In announcing the results, John Carlin, Archivist of the United States, hailed the People's Vote as truly a unique initiative. No other project, he explained, has invited Americans from all across the country to voice their opinion on the documents that have shaped our history, culture, and society. This is Talking History. The evidence would suggest that American children today are more privileged than ever in terms of what is available to them for their pleasure, good health, and general well-being. Nevertheless, as our guest this week has found, parents are even more concerned about their children than in the past. Talking History's Fred Nielsen reached Peter Stearns by telephone at his office at George Mason University.
To worry about one's children is in a parent's job description. But according to my guest, Peter Stearns, parental nervousness took new forms and reached new heights in the 20th century. Despite widespread improvements in health, education, and material well-being, mothers and fathers believe their children to be more vulnerable than ever. Peter Stearns is one of America's most prominent and prolific historians. Provost and professor of history at George Mason University, he is the author of Anxious Parents, A History of Modern Childbearing in America. Professor Stearns, welcome.
Thank you so much.
There was an awful lot of good news to celebrate for American children in the 20th century. They were less likely to die, their parents were less likely to die, children less likely to be orphaned, they had a higher standard of living. Was the news pretty good?
Largely, yes.
In what ways did that compare with previous centuries?
Well, the most striking changes were in the mortality rates, particularly for infants and young children. I mean, pretty obviously, by 1920, the likelihood of a child's dying in a family became well less than par, and that was really new in the human experience. Most families do not now have to expect at least one of their children to die before reaching adulthood, and that's just a striking change.
And we sort of forget the good news, though, for the theme of your book is not, in the end, that good news, but the fact that parents spent much of the 20th century worrying about their children and worrying about them in new ways. What made parents so nervous all of a sudden?
Well, there are several factors. One is I really think that partly because children were more likely to live, parents developed a new sense of responsibility. It became anguishingly awful if a child did become seriously ill or die. The attachment to individual children in some ways went up. There was also a growing sense that children were not really terribly competent. They were lovable. They would hopefully grow to be competent adults. But childhood was a time of weakness and vulnerability, so that new image was important. And finally, in terms of major factors, parents were adjusting to some really new activities and responsibilities in their lives and those of their children. For example, the requirement now that kids go to school, and for most parents, hopefully, the requirement that kids do fairly well in school, the addition of grading as part of the school experience. There were lots of new elements of childhood, and we've spent some time, and I think we're still spending some time, getting used to these elements.
You mentioned the educational changes, and as you describe them in your book, they sound really quite revolutionary. In the early 20th century, all of a sudden we find more formal discipline, a new curriculum, standardized tests, grades, report cards, and all of that. How does that change affect both children and their parents?
Well, obviously, from the child's standpoint, it's a new definition of primary responsibilities. Instead of work assisting the family, education and doing at least reasonably well or surviving school becomes the principal task of childhood. For parents, this means, frankly, that children turn from being potential economic assets to being liabilities and, in some senses, burdens. And I think that element enters into the equation of parental concern about children. We mostly don't think of children as burdens, but we're aware that we have responsibilities for them that they can't initially repay.
One of the fascinating things about your book, one of the things I enjoyed a lot, was the constant but ever-changing concern, specific concerns about what were going to happen to children. School desks, for example, were called curvature of the spine, was it?
Right. Yeah, we've had a lot of assumptions and continue to have some about the damage schools do to children. I don't mean that it's irrelevant to worry about this, but we allow ourselves to be swept away by some often misleading beliefs. And I think that reflects the newness of schooling, parents' realization that they don't have much control over large sections of their children's time. And this lends, along with the sense that children are frail and vulnerable, this leads to potential concerns about schooling that don't necessarily have a lot to do with reality. One of the most pervasive is the notion that children are being overwhelmed by homework, which is a belief that began in the 20th century and has, in terms of average situations, has in fact never been true.
In fact, quote one expert who declares that homework is what, a kind of criminal activity visited upon the young.
Right. Right. Which is, again, a statement that this is a new experience, parents don't quite know how to handle it, and we sure are worried about children being overwhelmed by aspects of modern life.
For us, in 2004, Dr. Spock is probably the most famous advice giver for children, for parents about children. Yet your book lists, it's a long list, all the parenting manuals from 1927 on. Spock was by no means the only one, and he's by no means the first. What led parents to mistrust their own instincts and to start buying books on how to raise their kids?
Well, they weren't brand new. There had been some in the 19th century, but there's no question that the urgency of looking to outside experts increased from the 1920s onward, partly because the experts themselves were thrusting themselves forward in more aggressive ways, claiming that there were new things discovered mainly by psychologists and doctors that parents had to know. So that's element number one. It was also true in the 1920s that grandparents were decreasingly likely to live with or near their adult children, which meant that you had less recourse to, you know, sort of standard passing on of wisdom from one generation to the next. But the main factor was parents began to believe that they had to do different things with their children from what their parents had done with them. And in order to do this, you didn't want to turn to the past. You wanted to turn to new and outside expertise.
The 19th century manuals tended to be more moral or religious in tone, didn't they?
Yeah, they were moral advice, whereas the new manuals, although they have moral content, more come with the cachet of science.
Has the quality of education declined over the last century?
Oh, no, I think rather the reverse. It may not be as good as it should be, but I think kids know more from a standpoint of formal academic life. They know more than they used to. They are required to do more than they used to be required to do. And obviously, we've spread education steadily outward from a middle-class sector to the population as a whole.
One of the interesting things about your book is to read the Cassandras all throughout the century. Was it 1927 or 1917, I think?
Yeah.
A third of the kids don't know the basic facts of American history. The sky is falling.
Right, exactly. And I don't mean, please, don't. Obviously, there are real reasons to be concerned about educational quality and performance, but we too infrequently get any sense of perspective. We've just worried about this pretty consistently through the 20th century, and we don't understand, as well as we should, that what we expect of children in terms of academic performance has actually gone up.
The last century saw, in addition to the educational changes we've talked about, quite a dramatic change in children's work. There was a steep decline in the amount of work children did, not only outside the home, but inside the home in the form of chores and other activities. Could you talk about that change a little bit, please?
Sure. Well, we're pretty aware that in 1900, most children, not most middle-class children, but most children of Americans, had formal jobs or informal work assignments on farms. And we know that that ended increasingly through enhanced regulation and inspection. What's interesting also, and we sort of know this one too, but I try to make the understanding here a little bit more formal, is that the informal tasks of children around the house, the chores, have gone down pretty steadily from the 1920s onward. There's still some required, a bit more for girls than for boys, but it becomes increasingly hard to expect much from children, and I think this is a real source of confusion, sometimes for children themselves, certainly for parents who just don't quite know what it's legitimate to assign.
What accounts for that decline?
Well, there are several factors. One is some of the stuff that kids used to be able to do has been taken over by other agencies. For example, we no longer have to shovel coal into furnaces for the most part. There aren't as many siblings to take care of. We have appliances that do stuff that kids used to do. So factor one is there has been a diminution of some of the household tasks that kids once helped take care of. But I think the other factor is parents become increasingly reluctant to burden their kids with domestic assignments. They think that they're working terribly hard in school. Kids pick the message up and become resistant to chores. Parents sometimes just feel that the whole process of getting kids to do something around the house is more trouble than it's worth. We become impatient, probably too quickly, and just figure that we'll take care of it ourselves. The result is we don't train kids, and you get involved in a somewhat vicious cycle, particularly where teenagers are concerned. the best child worker now is now a child in grade school. It gets worse after they age.
That's good news for me.
Very good.
Many parents have viewed the rise of consumerism and mass media of all kinds, comic books, movies, the internet, as threats to their children. Historically speaking, has that been a legitimate concern?
Well, that one's a hard one to answer. There's no question that from really quite early in the 20th century, worries about the quality of reading that was available to kids, pulp fiction of various sorts, to comic books, to radio, to movies, now to television, video games. There's just been a procession of things that we worried about. In one sense, the historical lesson is we probably overdo it because we have worried about each of these things and none of them has led to absolute disaster. On the other hand, they do represent a loss of parental control. They do expose children to things that in some cases they may not be ready for. I think the picture is a mixed one. It's good to know, I think, that we've worried about a lot of stuff that turned out not to be all that bad. That doesn't mean that we should therefore assume that anything available to children is all right. It's a mixed picture.
One of the problems is, of course, a concern about children being bored.
Well, that's the other side of the picture that complicates the whole thing immensely. We did begin to decide in the 20th century, as one of my colleagues put it, at some point early in the 20th century, we decided as parents that children should be happy. And that's really a fairly revolutionary responsibility. It comes along with consumerism. It's not a bad sentiment. I'm not opposed to it. But I think many parents begin to take on the obligation of sort of serving as entertainment directors for their children, particularly when they become concerned that the most ready sources of entertainment, like TV, are dangerous. So you find parents and increasingly grandparents just feeling a burden of making sure that kids are entertained, happy. We don't feel as confident in leaving kids to their own devices, and we certainly feel that boredom, which children themselves learn to express as a club over parental activities, boredom is a parental failure.
So we have parents anxious, increasingly nervous about all sorts of things, and that leads in some cases to new kinds of controls and restrictions on children. In your conclusion, you make what struck me, at least as you wrote it, as a rather provocative claim. You wrote that the chief effect of parental anxiety has been to create a whole host of new restrictions on children, which replace, but in many ways surpass, those that used to be imposed by the demands of child labor. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, yeah. I mean, we think, and in some ways we are, we think that as parents we give kids more latitude than they had in the past. And in some ways that's true. It is, however, obvious that schooling can be just as confining as work ever was. And then when you add on top of that parental anxieties about pushing kids into additional activities so that we won't have to worry about them getting into a good college, or surrounding kids with safety restrictions, which is an American specialty, we have a tremendous array of constraints and restrictions around children. I'm not saying they're awful, but my guess is they're excessive. They're not always good for kids, and they're certainly not good for parents because they operate with an assumption of imminent disaster that I think is usually unwarranted.
You make the point that it might help knowing what earlier generations went through or what they thought they were facing. It's a kind of historical argument for better parenting, that historical perspective might enable us to have a better understanding of what parenting can be about.
Well, that's my belief. Basically, I think if we understand the historical origin of some of our current worries and anxieties about children, we may not decide to drop those worries, but we may be able to get a bit of a better handle on them. The thing that actually concerned me most in doing the book was the pretty inescapable realization that parents are less happy being parents than they used to be, even though objectively some aspects of childhood are easier to handle than they were several generations back. It's the lack of enjoyment in parenting, and I don't mean for everybody or all the time, but it's the sense that parenting is an awesome and nerve-wracking responsibility that I think we need to be able to discuss in somewhat new ways.
Yes, that's an interesting point. There was a kind of a tipping point around 1930, was it?
Yeah, it's hard to get data before the 30s, but in the 30s, I mean, the data that are most striking is in the 30s, a childless couple was expressed about the same degree of happiness as did a couple with children. Since then, the balance has tipped steadily and increasingly toward the side of married people without children expressing greater satisfaction with life than married people with children. The only category of parent that says that he's happier than his childless counterpart is a divorced man, and they may be happy because few of them have much to do with their children.
Well, you write near the end of your book that children, on the whole, continue to make the transition into reasonably competent, achieving adulthood. And if the point of being a child is to turn into a responsible adult, the news would seem in the end to still be pretty good.
Yeah, I didn't write the book with the sense that we're failing our children. I do think there's increasing evidence that certain kinds of children don't feel as competent as they should be encouraged to feel, and adulthood for many is delayed because of the dependence in which worried parents keep their children. But I don't think we've ruined generations of American children. I do think we make parenting less enjoyable than it might be.
Well, Professor Stearns, thanks so much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
I've been visiting with Peter Stearns, the author of Anxious Parents, A History of Modern Child Rearing in America.
Writing a constitution isn't easy. True, the framers of the U.S. Constitution in 1787 did it in only 4 months. But as James Banner explains, the circumstances surrounding that effort and the recent failure to construct a frame of government for the European Union are quite different.
The European Union's failure some months ago to write a constitution may seem a significant failure of political imagination. Instead, it's probably only a temporary setback along the road to European government. No constitution making is easy. The U.S. Constitution was hard won in its own day, but it was ratified and it survived, and as long as its leaders can summon fresh political will, Europe won't long be without its own governing plan. When the framers of the U.S. Constitution hammered out their document in 4 months in 1787, they were writing upon a relatively blank historical slate. Centuries of warfare, land trading treaties, and memory didn't burden their deliberations. The American people spoke a common tongue, and the vast majority shared a Protestant faith. None of the uniting states had ever warred on each other as colonies. Since no new states were about to join the original 13, the just-born nation didn't face the double crisis of writing a constitution while admitting new members, what Europe faces today. None had had to build a powerful state apparatus, including standing armies, to defend itself against other powerful neighboring states. For Europe, it's vastly different. Centuries of state and civil warfare, radical revolutions, and Holocaust have scarred its face and poisoned relations between its people. Representative democracy has had to be extracted out of feudal and royal rule. The people's will has sometimes had to be gained by radical acts at the barricades. A babble of tongues, different faiths, and distinct cultures have long divided its inhabitants. The stumbling block now concerns representation in the European Council. Europeans shouldn't wonder that it's a tough one to surmount. In 1787, the most populous American states claimed precedence over the less peopled ones, and the smaller states sought protection from the large. The resulting compromise, which eventuated an equal representation in the Senate and proportional representation in the House, was only one of many compromises worked out in Philadelphia. Some of the others were regrettable. One was the creation of that curious and undemocratic institution, the Electoral College. Another was the devil's bargain of counting three-fifths of the slaves for representation in the House. The American Constitution is not perfect and never has been. So hard and huge a task it was to found the Roman people, Virgil wrote early in the Aeneid some 2,000 years ago, the same huge difficulty now faces Europe as it seeks to reconstitute itself through an unprecedented written constitution under conditions vastly different from those that faced the framers. No doubt its constitution will be written before long. And then, like the United States before it, Europe is likely to emerge stronger rather than weaker for the struggle, its compromises, and their eventual acceptance.
You've been listening to James Banner, an independent historian of the early republic. Banner's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. This is Talking History. And finally, we continue with our reading of another passage from the unpublished diary of J.C. Wilmarth, Union soldier from Massachusetts. Wilmarth, now a Confederate prisoner, marks his 22nd birthday at Andersonville Prison. August 4, 1864. No roll call today. Still dying off very fast, at the rate of 100 per day. In the morning, the camp seems lined with dead men who are laid out in front of their several rude huts with toes tied to keep them in shape. All their friends could do for them. Others that would have no friends or quarters would be lying in the filthy streets and be carried out by some of the prisoners who might get an extra cup of meal from the quartermaster. August 5th. My birthday to be passed in Andersonville. I'm 22. Shall I live to see the next birthday? It's very doubtful, and perhaps my gravestone will read aged 22. But we must all die sometime, and I'll try and be ready. We tell each other in this place that we still live, and that the Johnnies ain't quite killed us yet, and so we live day by day. Some of the prisoners who get easily discouraged soon grow sick and die. August 6th. This is the day that report said we was to be paroled, but we see no signs of it. Will it ever come? Will we ever get out of this land of cornmeal and Confederacy? And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. We welcome your comments or suggestions for future shows, which you can send us either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. A Moment in Time is produced by Dan Roberts and distributed by WCBE-FM in Richmond, Virginia. For more information, visit amomentintime.com. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.